make history. So if you get together and you, if you're a collective, you can change anything you set your minds to.
Well, Raoul Peck, we're going to continue our conversation. And by the way, congratulations on your BAFTA, the
Thank
equivalent
you.
Of the Oscars in the United States for I Am Not Your Negro, about James Baldwin. The new film, The Young Karl Marx, out today in New York and Los Angeles. I am Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Special thanks to our producers, Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Nermin, Sheikh Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. Thanks for joining us.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Il Camille and Fritzois, Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge in Portland. From Los Angeles, MC Il Camille's divine mission is to uplift the world through Heirloom, her latest record. Fritzois' latest, the self-written and produced Avenue A, is filled with a soul-drenched sound that doesn't quite sit in a neat box of influences. The night also includes DJ sets by DJ Black Daria and DJ Shishi of Everyday Mixtapes. This is a 21 and over event. Again, that's Il Camille and Fritzois, Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Michael Casehammer in concert on Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Newmark Theater in Portland. Michael Casehammer, known mostly as Canadian jazz and boogie-woogie pianist and vocalist, will be performing with a six-piece band touring for his 11th album called No Filter. Again, that's Michael Casehammer in concert on Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Newmark Theater, 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the governor of Florida, a longtime friend of the NRA, has put his support behind several gun control-esque bills in the state legislature.
A man has been shot by a security guard at a bar in southeast Portland.
And a company has pled guilty to releasing deadly anhydrous ammonia from a plant in St. Helens in 2015.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, February 23rd, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The Oregonian reports that a Utah-based company that manufactures commercial explosives pled guilty in federal court Friday to failing to report a large-scale ammonia discharge in the Portland area. Dyno Nobel Incorporated admitted to releasing more than 6 tons of anhydrous ammonia vapor into the air over a 3-day period in July 2015. The discharge came from its plant just outside St. Helens, Oregon, located on the shore of the Columbia River across from Kalama, Washington. The company also acknowledged it did not immediately notify the National Response Center, which is required under federal law. Company personnel knew the excessive ammonia emissions were occurring but made no effort to alert authorities until more than a week after the first discharge. Anhydrous ammonia is a pungent gas with suffocating fumes. Exposure to high concentrations can lead to death, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The emissions triggered numerous complaints from neighboring residents in Columbia County who reported foul odors, eye irritation, and difficulty breathing, according to prosecutors.
A security guard shot at a man at a bar in southeast Portland early this morning, according to a press release from Portland Police Bureau. Officers responded to the Speakeasy Lounge near Southeast 162nd Avenue and Stark Street at 1:34 in the morning. According to the police, there was an altercation between the man and a customer, which escalated when the man was asked to leave. He reportedly broke the bar's front door and yelled threats, whereupon the security guard fired his weapon. The man was seriously injured, but his wounds are not life-threatening. He was transported to an area hospital. The security guard is reportedly cooperating with the investigation being conducted by the Bureau's Assault Detail and Forensic Evidence Division. The guard surrendered his firearm, which was seized as evidence. It is unclear at this time how many shots were fired, if the guard worked for the bar or another company, or if the guard had certification from the State Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to have a firearm on duty. The story will be updated as that information becomes available.
This morning, as President Trump was repeating the easily refuted claim that arming teachers would solve gun violence, Florida's Republican governor disagreed with him, instead deciding to spend $450 million to put law enforcement officers in schools. Governor Rick Scott also called for tougher background checks and waiting periods. Legislators in Florida also introduced a bill to increase the minimum age for purchasing a firearm from 18 to 21. The governor and NRA-supported Republican did not take the step of banning the AR-15 rifle, a core demand of the student survivors of the recent mass shooting in the state.
Meanwhile, amidst a social media campaign to boycott companies that have been offering deep discounts to NRA members, car rental companies Enterprise, Alamo, and National have dropped their associations with the group. Dozens of other companies have also dropped their ties to the NRA. These including hotels such as Best Western and Wyndham Hotels, as well as the First National Bank of Omaha, one of the country's largest banking institutions. Today, activists online are targeting package carrier FedEx and car rental companies Avis and Hertz.
A community group in Corvallis is organizing to save storied and popular local resource. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more.
A group of students and citizens in Corvallis has been organizing to save a big yellow house in the city's downtown. It isn't just any house, though. Called the Sunflower House, it houses a variety of groups and projects as the home of the Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center. Oregon State University, which occupies a huge chunk of the city's geography and economic life, has plans to bulldoze the house, which is located on a large, mostly empty plot, and build parking and housing. That's what prompted the group Save Our Sunflower House, formerly Save CMLC, to take action. Member Genevieve Prentice spoke with me yesterday and explained the place of this resource in Corvallis.
It provides a space for people from many diverse cultures across Corvallis and international students, the families of international workers that have come to work at the university, and just provides a space for people to come together and get to know each other and become a community. And there's nothing else like that. I don't think I've even seen anything quite like that in other cities that I've been to.
Their agitation prompted OSU to respond, offering a smaller house further away from the city center.
OSU's stance was nothing for CMLC. Just get out, at such and such a time, we're raising the building. And there was no conversation happening. So due to the public pressure that was put on, a conversation began. And OSU, I believe, has begun to have some understanding of the value of what goes on. But OSU is looking at it merely as on a programmatic level. They look at it like any of the other programs that they offer. They're not looking at it as space itself that has a history of bringing people in this community together.
The city itself has shown strong support for the Sunflower House.
We've packed council chamber a few times with people all holding sunflowers.
The university's plan to bulldoze the Sunflower House must still be approved by the city planning commission and city council. Stay tuned next week for a more in-depth look at this story as it continues to develop. For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman. For this story, I spoke with Genevieve Prentice of the group Save Our Sunflower House.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin at 5:30. At 6, it's Native America Calling from Native Voice 1. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, you guessed it, rain and snow with a low of 36. Tomorrow has a 20% chance of rain and will reach a balmy high of 47 degrees. Today in history, in the year 1455, according to tradition, Johannes Gutenberg published the first edition of his Bible, the first book printed in Europe using movable type. 99 years later, on this day in 1554, the Mapuche people of Chile scored a victory against Spanish invaders at the Battle of Merihuanu. The Mapuches remained independent until, ironically, the nation of Chile gained its independence from Spain and occupied Mapuche territory. The quote of the day is a traditional saying of the Mapuche people, who remain Chile's largest indigenous group. Quote, "As life is so short, shouldn't we meet again?" End quote.
No one questions the power of the NRA to influence elections and drive their pro-gun agenda, but this time they may have run up against a group with more backbone than your typical liberal, angry high school students. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this.
Florida Senator Marco Rubio received just under $10,000 in donations from the National Rifle Association before and immediately after last year's general election. His take was twice as high as the next highest Florida recipient. So it's not surprising that the day after the shooting, Rubio immediately began damage control to discourage the discussion of tougher gun laws that typically comes in the wake of a mass shooting.
Whether it's a political assassination of one person or the mass killing of many, if one person decides to do it and they're committed to that task, it is a very difficult thing to stop.
The senator's comments obviously ignore the fact that Australia and the United Kingdom and Canada have all figured out how to dramatically reduce mass shootings by tightening gun laws and outlawing semi-automatic and automatic weapons. Of course, were the senator to recognize and support the issue, it might affect his campaign's bottom line. Democrats repeated their call for tighter gun control and an assault weapons ban, but with Congress and the presidency firmly in Republican hands, there's little likelihood of any significant tightening of the laws. Surprisingly, despite receiving over $21 million in support from the NRA during the presidential election, Trump did make two small gestures. He ordered a ban on the sale of pump stocks, a move that the NRA was said to have blessed, and he also indicated that he'd favor tightening background checks and endorsed raising from 18 to 21 the minimum age to purchase long guns. The NRA quickly rejected that suggestion. Sadly, it says something about our skewed perspective that currently you can buy an AR-15 and a high-capacity magazine 3 years before you can legally buy a beer in this country. Parkland students, however, have not taken all this lying down. In the immediate aftermath, many students spoke forcefully in favor of tightening gun restrictions. Here's 17-year-old David Hogg.
There's something seriously wrong here. And some of our policymakers and some people need to look in the mirror and take some action, because ideas are great, but without action, ideas stay ideas and children die.
At a rally 3 days after the shooting, Emma Gonzalez made heartfelt pleas for action and appeared to directly respond to Marco Rubio's comments on the Senate floor.
If all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see. Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this. We call BS!
A few days later, the students organized a bus trip to the Florida State Capitol in Tallahassee to demand tougher gun laws, but the state's legislators confirmed Emma's worst fears by just offering a prayer and refusing to consider any gun control measures. Soon thereafter, right-wing groups began to use social media to question the motives of the student activists, describing them as, quote, crisis actors, unquote. Conservative commentators not only questioned the legitimacy of the student efforts, but their ability to act in a coordinated manner. Here's CNN commentator Jack Kingston.
Their sorrow can very easily be hijacked by left-wing groups. I say this sincerely. Do we really think 17-year-olds on their own are going to plan a nationwide rally?
Clearly, that is a comment from a man who does not understand the power of social media in the hands of an inspired high school student. On Wednesday, as Donald Trump was meeting with grieving parents and survivors at the White House, students from around the country were walking out of class and rallying to demand safe schools and sensible gun laws. And who knows, maybe this time it will be different. These student activists are intelligent and motivated, and they have something that every politician wants.
That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS! If you agree, register to vote. Contact your local congresspeople. Give them a piece of your mind.
Let's hope they can motivate their peers to register and vote and their parents to get out and vote as well. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Today's episode of the 420 Drug War News takes a look at the support in Congress and the country for the hardline stance on cannabis taken by current Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Host Dean Becker speaks with a former counsel to the House of Representatives, courtesy of KPFT Houston and the Pacifica Network.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
From 1979 to 1989, Eric E. Sterling served as assistant counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. He helped write several federal laws concerning firearms, pornography, money laundering, organized crime, and most notably, drugs. He played a central role in Congress's enactment of the infamous mandatory minimum drug sentences back in 1986. He was the principal aide in developing the Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 1984 and the Anti-Drug Abuse Acts of 86 and 88. And with that, I want to welcome my friend, Eric Sterling. How are you, sir?
Hello, Dean. It's good to join you and your listeners again today.
Eric, I'm agitated today. I'm just wanting to get people with knowledge, people with credentials to respond to the likes of U.S. Attorney Jeff Sessions and his, declaring pot smokers to be bad people and that it has no benefit. And then we have this new, Trump administration drug policy coming forward at this time. And I just wanted to get your response to both of those situations. And I'll just turn it over to you for a minute, sir.
Okay. I mean, I wouldn't despair as much as you are. We haven't seen a rallying to Jeff Sessions' green light to U.S. attorneys to begin curbing the medical cannabis or the recreational cannabis programs in the various states. There have been few announcements that have suggested that U.S. attorneys are now feeling emboldened. It's not to say that there haven't been a few, but my perception is that within the Justice Department, the reaction was like, really? This is where you're taking us? This is not the leadership we're looking for. We're in a very, very different place than we were just 10 years ago, and certainly in the days when Jeff Sessions was a federal prosecutor in the 1980s. It's certainly the case that Sessions is out of touch and out of date, but he is a weak attorney general. He's not strongly supported by the president, and I don't think he's getting strong support from the Congress.
That was Eric Sterling, who worked with the House Judiciary Committee to come up with mandatory minimum laws. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Environmental advocates and tribal leaders have declared a major victory as a federal court has rejected the Trump administration's attempt to suspend a methane gas regulation. The Natural Resources Defense Council said the decision once again sends a message to this administration that it will not get away with illegal handouts to industry at the expense of Americans' health and the environment. The latest rebuke to Trump's attempt to derail the Bureau of Land Management's waste prevention rule was delivered late Thursday by the U.S. District Court for the District of Northern California. This was in response to suits filed by a number of environmental groups, as well as the states of California and New Mexico, over the rule suspension. The judge ruled that the plaintiffs have shown irreparable injury caused by the waste of a publicly owned natural gas, increased air pollution and associated health impacts, and exacerbated climate impacts.
The United Nations continues to work on a ceasefire resolution aimed at ending the bombardment of eastern Ghouta by Syrian government forces. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, more than 400 people have been killed in the area since Sunday alone. Government forces and Russian warplanes have been dropping bombs on the Damascus suburb in an effort to push the last remaining rebels out. Ghouta, with a population of about 400,000 people, has been a target for President Bashar al-Assad's forces since 2013. United Nations and humanitarian groups are calling the most recent attacks a humanitarian tragedy. Stéphane de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy to Syria, told the Security Council on Tuesday that, quote, "the humanitarian situation in eastern Ghouta is appalling and, therefore, we need a ceasefire that stops both the horrific heavy bombardment of eastern Ghouta and the indiscriminate mortar shelling on Damascus," end quote. A vote on the ceasefire had been scheduled for this morning, but has been held up due to negotiations over wording of the resolution. Al Jazeera is reporting that Russia is the holdout.
The United States Embassy in Israel will move to Jerusalem in May. That's according to a statement released today by the State Department. In January, Mike Pence said the move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem wasn't expected to be completed until 2019. The new May 2018 timeline will coincide with the 70th anniversary of Israel's Declaration of Independence. The anniversary, celebrated by Israelis, is mourned by Palestinians, who refer to May 15th as Nakba Day of the catastrophe. The formation of the State of Israel prompted the mass expulsion of at least 750,000 of the 1.9 million Palestinians who lived there. Trump's announcement in December of last year that he planned to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was met with protest by Palestinians who saw it as legitimizing Israel's claim to the Holy City. Several Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during protests that broke out following the announcement. Syed Erekat, Secretary General of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, told Al Jazeera that the move would result in, quote, "the destruction of the two-state option," end quote. It is not yet known exactly where the new U.S. embassy will be located.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Another controversial verdict in Canada has again sparked anger among First Nations people. A farmer was recently acquitted in the shooting death of a Native man. And this week, a not guilty verdict was reached in the death of teenager Tina Fontaine. Her case prompted a national investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
2 weeks to the day after the acquittal in the case of the shooting death of Colton Bushy in Saskatchewan, another trial has ended in a not guilty verdict, this time in Manitoba. The body of 15-year-old Tina Fontaine was pulled from the Red River in Winnipeg in August of 2014, 8 days after she had been reported missing. A year later, 56-year-old Roger Cormier was charged with second-degree murder in her death. It took the jury 11 hours of deliberation before returning a not guilty verdict. Native leaders say Tina, who was in foster care at the time of her death, was completely let down by the social safety net that was supposed to keep her safe. Arlen Dumas is the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
How can we talk about reconciliation when the very nets that we're asked to participate in do not fulfill what they're supposed to fulfill? We can no longer maintain these mechanisms that are prescribed to us. If we want reconciliation and truly protect our children and our families, we can no longer allow the status quo to exist. This is unacceptable.
The jury heard that Tina was being sexually exploited after coming to Winnipeg from her community to the north. Her death sparked renewed calls at the time that eventually led to an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And as in the Colton Bushy case 2 weeks ago, there were more calls to change the justice system. One leader said everyone across Canada should be ashamed of themselves for the injustice that occurred in the Tina Fontaine case. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An all-volunteer emergency roadside assistance group on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota is being recognized for its work. As Jim Kent reports, there are dozens of posts on The Guardian's social media page expressing thanks for responding to calls for help.
The Guardians were founded in 2015 after Gerald Mesteth broke down on a Pine Ridge Reservation road.
How it started was I was on the side of the road coming back from work, and my car overheated. And I didn't have no water, no way to get it going, and it was pretty cold out. The windows were frosting, and no one pulled over for me, and I had no way to call for help. So I sat there for a couple hours until I finally got help. That's when I got the idea to get a truck and go around and help people that are stalled out.
Mesteth began cruising the roads in his free time, and whether it was a tow or a battery jump, there was never any cost to the stranded driver. Within a month, he'd founded the Guardians with his brother, Derek Thunderhawk. Others soon joined to volunteer as drivers or dispatchers. Mesteth notes that being a part of the group requires a commitment.
It's overwhelming at times, but it's still rewarding because that's what I like to do, is help people.
Helene Gaddy says the Guardians helped her friends with a dead battery in sub-zero weather.
We were at winter camp down in Yellow Bear Canyon, and it's in the middle of a blizzard. And then they were like, what are we going to do? And we were like, we'll call the Guardians. And they came, I mean, with a full entourage.
Gaddy says just knowing the Guardians are there if you need them has dramatically changed life for many on the reservation. The Guardians still don't charge for services and exist from funds supplied by their members and from public donations. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Thanks for listening and have a good evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
Community radio is radio for the people, by the people. At KBOO, your neighbors, coworkers, and friends make radio so you can be sure that the issues they bring to you are the issues that matter. We believe strong communities invest in sharing knowledge with each other. Every month, KBOO offers free classes in the art of radio broadcasting so Portland can stay informed. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a gun-free school is a magnet for bad people, is a real statement from the actual president in response to a horrific event in which a 19-year-old shot and killed 17 people at his former high school in Parkland, Florida, which suggests that waiting for Donald Trump to act to prevent gun violence should be no part of an effort to prevent gun violence. And if Americans really want to stop being the only country where this happens, who keeps officially claiming that there's no way to prevent it, it will require not just deep examination of the multiple roots of mass violence of this sort, but also an approach to political processes that keeps its eye on the prize of real change. We'll talk about possibilities of movement on the issue of gun control and about some of the other cultural aspects of this violence, whose examination has to be part of getting beyond this cycle of mass shootings and thoughts and prayers and more mass shootings. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America and author of the book The Business of America is Lobbying. He wrote, Parkland could be a turning point for gun control for Vox.com. We'll also hear from Pat Elder, author of the book Military Recruiting in the United States and director of the National Coalition to Protect Student Privacy, which resists the militarization.